Message and data rates may apply. Consult a doctor prior to use.
Wow, you look amazing. What have you been doing?
I'm sure you've heard of Ozempic, Wegovy, and the other GLP-1 medications, right? Well, I found this great company called Zelthy. If you qualify, their providers can prescribe medications like Ozempic and Wegovy and other GLP-1 medications that are 80 to 90% less expensive, all 100% online.
I can get GLP-1 medications for 80 to 90% less and do it all online? No doctor's office or pharmacy?
Yes, Zelthy can provide semaglutide or tirzepatide, the active ingredients in Ozempic and other expensive GLP-1s. But for 80 to 90% less and ship directly to your door.
How do I get started with Zelthy?
Call #250 with the word care to get started today with Zelthy. Get the same active ingredients in Wegovy or Ozempic, but for 80 to 90% less and 100% online. Don't wait. Call #250 with the word care right now for a link to your exclusive offer. Call #250 with the word care. That's #250 with the word care. #250 and care.
We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Styles McKenzie helping you make those rooms sing. Today's style tip. When it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild, like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Fierce. This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
Everything from clothing to household items are getting more expensive each day. The world of fast fashion has complicated clothing production by outsourcing around the world to whoever can sew them the cheapest. And now you, the consumer, are paying the price with rising costs. American Giant is about keeping things simple and close to home. They aren't affected by tariffs because their products never leave the U.S. So when you buy from American Giant, you're taking a stand for hardworking people, local communities, and quality clothes. American Giant directly supports American manufacturers and ensures you aren't footing that tariff bill. Support American-made, tariff-free clothing with American Giant with American Giant. Get 20% off your first order when you use promo code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com. That's 20% off when you use code STAPLE20 at American-Giant.com.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Picture this. You are on a jury in one of the most talked about murder trials in the country. And you're expecting bombshells, DNA revelations, emotional testimonies, and maybe even a few courtroom meltdowns. But before anyone even mentions the word murder, there's a thick stack of paperwork and a bench full of lawyers fighting over what can and cannot be said. That is precisely what is happening right now in the case against Brian Koberger. And this isn't anything new. Most trials, the big key parts are all decided well before the actual trial begins, through motions and hearings and all of that. And it's what's been happening most recently in the last week or so, depending on when you're watching this. April 18th of 2025, the judge in the Brian Koberger case sat down and drew a line in the sand. Let's start with the language. The courtroom equivalent of, watch your mouth. I don't know. Nobody said it to me. Watch your mouth. I'm trying to think of how the tone was. I don't say it that often. But I'm trying to think how it was said to me. Watch your mouth. Something like that. The defense wanted to state, wanted the state rather muzzled from using words like murder, murderer, or murder weapon in a murder case. Yeah, makes sense, right? Their argument that these words are emotionally loaded. Oh, they are, though. But you have a person on trial for murder, so let's exit snowflake land and let's go back to the real world, shall we? They're saying using them would bias the jury from the jump. Well, they do know they're there for a murder trial, so I don't know that that's really the case. But good tactic. Good try, Ann Taylor. The judge wasn't buying it. He essentially said, look, we all know why we're here. It's a murder trial. The prosecution can say what the charges are as long as they don't present it like it's fact until the evidence is in. So no, the prosecutor can't call Koberger the killer during opening statements. But referring to the charges, totally fair game. The jury knows they're not there for a parking ticket. Then came the request to ban the terms psychopath and sociopath. Now, this one actually stuck. The court granted it. Why? Because there is no diagnosis, no expert testimony lined up to back those terms, and nothing legally relevant about slapping armchair psychology onto a murder charge. The judge shut that down with finality. The prosecution can't throw around clinical terms without the clinical backing, which, if you think about it, is a low bar for dignity in a courtroom, but one we apparently still have to clarify in writing. Now, let's talk about the DNA, the three-letter acronym that tends to carry more weight in a jury box than 100 eyewitnesses, specifically the kind of DNA known in pop culture as touch DNA or contact DNA. The state's lab expert, Nolan, is set to testify about DNA found on, well, yeah, the knife sheath discovered next to one of the victims. Nolan believes that DNA likely came from direct contact, someone touching it, but the court stepped in and said, okay, you can say that, but let's tone down the jargon. The judge strongly suggested the use of the phrase touch DNA, discouraged the use of that term touch DNA, contact DNA, or trace DNA, not because they're inaccurate, but because they can confuse jurors and imply a level of certainty that does not exist. It's like calling a paper towel super absorbent on the packaging when it really is just kind of smears things around. It's still paper towel. It's supposed to be absorbent. It's not technically a lie, but it creates a misleading impression. So Nolan can still testify that the DNA likely came from direct transfer based on concentration and profile type, but she has to stay and state that in plain terms, even less scientific terms, actually. And both sides are expected to walk a fine line between clarity and scientific showboating. So the term DNA is going to be in it. Not touch DNA, just DNA, which actually is a bit stronger of a term than predicating it with something in front of it. So this, I would say, is a win for the prosecution. Which brings us to one of the more secretive corners of this case. The investigative genetic genealogy, or IGG. This is the method that allegedly helped identify Koberger using DNA databases designed for ancestry searches. Not criminal investigations. It's kind of like using 23andMe to track down a suspect's third cousin and then working backwards. Powerful, absolutely. Admissible? Not this time. But that's not anything that's going to hurt the prosecution. Both sides agree, no IGG at trial. Remember how long they argued about this? Of is it admissible? Is it not? Could they have done this? Should they have done this? All that. Well, the court already said it's admissible. It's just fine. There's no laws preventing anybody from getting the IGG DNA information the way that they did. So there's no need to really put more predicates in front of it. The jury will be told only that a tip led to Koberger, and they'll be told not to worry about how that tip came in, which, if you're sitting in the jury box, is a little like watching a second half of a movie without knowing how the characters got there. But those are the rules. Now, there's one more pretrial ruling that says a lot about the tone the trial is going to take. Koberger's defense asked the court to make sure his autism couldn't be used against him, despite them bringing this up. If the trial goes into sentencing phases, the state agreed. They said they don't plan to use autism spectrum disorder as an aggravating factor, which is legal speak for a reason to push for the death penalty. The judge formalized that. However, if the defense brings it up as a mitigating factor, as in something the jury should consider to be lenient, then the state is allowed to respond. That might sound like common sense, but it's actually a tightly controlled balance. The court is drawing a boundary. Koberger's diagnosis isn't a free pass, nor is it a red flag. It's only relevant if the defense chooses to make it relevant. And that's something the jury may never even hear, depending on how the case actually plays out. What we're seeing here is a kind of narrative sandboxing being built around the trial. The judge is setting the parameter, outlining what the jury can hear and what's off limits. This isn't about truth versus lies. It's about rules versus chaos. The courtroom isn't a Netflix docuseries yet. It doesn't reward dramatic twists or gut feelings. It runs on what's admissible, provable, and not outrageously prejudicial. And those lines are often drawn not by what happened, but how cleanly it can be explained. Every one of those rulings, from the words prosecutors can say to the forensic lingo to the evidence that got quietly swept under the rug, shapes how the story of this case will be told in court. It controls what the jury will see, and just as importantly, what they won't see. Because in a case that's already been tried 100 times on social media, the actual trial is now being trimmed and sculpted down to something leaner, stricter, and if the court has its way, a little less theoretical. And a little less theatrical as well. And that's the thing about justice systems. They don't just care about what's said, but how it's said, when it's said, and why. It's less of a whodunit and more of a game of who gets to say what. Why? Appellate issues. You don't want something in there that can trigger a redo after millions of dollars are spent on this thing, and somebody says the wrong term out loud that they already agreed on saying, look, we can't say this, or it's just kind of lightly said, don't say this. The rules are there. So anybody taking the stand, the attorneys, everybody, here's the rules, follow them. We don't want to have to do this again. So when the jury eventually walks in, they won't be hearing about tips from IgG databases. They won't be told Koberger's a sociopath. They won't hear his DNA described in pop science language that sounds like it came from a CSI episode. They'll hear the prosecution call this a murder case, not a murder fact. And when Koberger's defense steps up, they'll be walking the same tightrope, careful to defend without leaning on unpermitted psychology or vague suggestions. It's like when you go to a restaurant, they don't read off the ingredient list to you to tell you what you're getting. If you're ordering a Big Mac, they're not going to say, okay, it contains this amount of beef, this is the type of beef, these sort of seasonings, here's exactly where they all come into play, these sort of preservatives. Let me tell you where the lettuce came from, and the cheese, and the bun that never goes bad. I don't know that anybody can truly explain that one, but it is what it is. They're just going to call it a Big Mac. They're going to call it what it is. The evidence will come. The arguments will unfold, but they'll do it within boundaries that are now firmly set. And speaking of boundaries, this next part is where things get real, because now the court's decided what the jury can't hear. It's time to look at what they will hear. The Amazon records, the surveillance video, the expert DNA testimony, all of it. The state has its evidence lined up. So let's get into that part. This case that's made so many headlines and fills Reddit threads. The actual evidence, not the vibes, not the viral theories, but the physical stuff that's officially allowed into court. After the pretrial fencing and legal tightropes, this is where the prosecution finally gets to lay some bricks down. And if you're Brian Koberger, this is also the part where things start feeling real. Getting real, kids. First up, Amazon. Yeah, that Amazon. In the sea of digital evidence, nothing hits harder than cold transactional data, especially when it lines up a bad coincidence in a true crime doc. The state has successfully linked an Amazon account registered to Brian Koberger to the purchase of a K-bar knife and sheath, the same style of weapon believed to be used in the stabbings. The account showed not just a one-click buy, but a whole trail of curiosity. Pages visited, knife listings browsed, shipping status tracked. The package was sent to Koberger's name at his family house in Pennsylvania. That alone might make someone shift in their seat. Not the timeline, well, but the timeline actually makes it more pointed. The knife was ordered roughly 8 months before the homicides. That places it well outside of any knee-jerk reaction or impulsive decision, and right into the kind of detail prosecutors love. A slow burn, not a flash. Post-murder. The same Amazon account logged activity around deleting search history, browsing K-bar listings again. Oops, maybe that wasn't a great idea to order that under your name and sending it to your parents' house. Maybe you should have done like an Amazon locker at a Whole Foods under a different name. But you know, Brian can't always be the smartest one in the room. Whether that was a weird twist, morbid curiosity, or cleanup is up for the jury to decide, but the digital fingerprints are in. The defense tried to shut this down, arguing that the Amazon activity was out of context, incomplete, and unfairly prejudicial. They pointed out that just because someone clicks on a page doesn't mean they're the one who did it. Fair enough. They even brought in a digital forensic expert, David Howell, who argued to attribute Amazon activity to a specific person. You need more. Device IDs, cross-device activity, behavioral targeting data. In short, the full digital ecology. But the judge didn't bite. His response was simple, that what's cross-examination is actually for. The evidence isn't unfairly prejudicial on its face. The defense can challenge it, but it's going to the jury. Good luck convincing a jury that somehow the Amazon history that everybody looks at on their own accounts is not what it looks like. And that somehow Brian Koberger's is so much different. It's not. So the jury will hear about this Amazon trail, and they'll have to consider whether Brian Koberger bought that knife. More importantly, they'll be asked to consider whether the person who ordered it is the same person whose DNA ended up on the sheath found next to one of the victims. And that's the second big brick in the state's wall, DNA. The knife sheath is the forensic centerpiece of the case. It's not hypothetical. It's not symbolic. It's physical evidence that was photographed, logged, and tested, and it yielded a DNA profile. According to the Idaho State Police Lab, the DNA was a single-source male profile, and the state's expert, Riley Nolan, is going to testify that the amount of DNA present and the clarity of the profile make it more likely that it came from a direct transfer. In plain terms, she believed the person who left the DNA was someone who physically touched the sheath. Nolan won't be allowed to say it was touch DNA, like we said in court, because the judge, as we covered earlier, doesn't want the jury assuming that means direct contact happened in certainty. The term has a nice little TV ring to it, but it tends to oversimplify complex science. Instead, she'll describe the variables in quantity, the single source result, and the absence of environmental contamination. And when she does, the jury will be sitting there going, oh my God, when is this going to be over? Because technical jargon and such doesn't usually land very well with a jury. They want cold, hard facts. Not all the simmering technological details that end up getting you to the actual fact. Just get to the fact. Keep it simple, stupid. It's not a smoking gun, but it's not a shrug either. It's a strong implication. The defense will no doubt come after this from an angle of transfer, secondary transfer. Someone else having touched the sheath before it got there. They've already planted the idea that Koberger's DNA might have gotten there through indirect means. And that's a legitimate question, kind of. But the court has ruled that Nolan's testimony about direct transfer is fair game. She's not saying when it happened or how, just that the DNA present makes direct contact more likely than not. And if you're a smart person, you should yield to experts, not somebody on the internet. Like me, or anyone, really. Listen to the experts. The judge also made another critical call. He warned the prosecution about the danger of overhyping DNA stats. During the grand jury process, the lab analyst testified that the DNA from the sheath was 5.37 octillion times more likely to belong to Koberger than a random person from the population. That's 5.37 followed by 27 zeros. That's a lot. The prosecutor tried to simplify it by saying, so you're saying like it's 1 in 5 octillion people? The analyst responded with a correction, noting that it's not how likelihood ratios work. And the court agreed. In other words, you can't tell a jury that finding Koberger's DNA is like winning the lottery in reverse. It creates a false sense of certainty. So at trial, those stats can still be discussed, but not in a way that suggests cartoon-level odds of guilt, even though it points to that. It has to be scientifically sound, not mathematically theatrical. Kind of hard to do, though, when the theatrics of the math are quite theatrical. And while DNA and Amazon make for solid anchors in the case, they're not the only ones. There's also the car, the now infamous white Hyundai Elantra. Surveillance videos captured a vehicle matching that make and model circling near the King Road house in the early morning hours of November 13th. According to law enforcement, the same vehicle is seen entering the area around 4:04 a.m. and then speeding away at 4:20 a.m. A window that matches the alleged time of the murders. Huh. That's a weird coincidence for the guy who bought the knife sheath and the knife. It has his DNA on the knife itself? Wonder what that all could mean. Again, for the jury, defense tried to argue that calling all of these sightings the same vehicle was speculative. After all, there's no unbroken video showing the car moving from one camera to the next, no footage of it pulling into the house or catching a plate. But the court ruled that trained law enforcement officials can testify to their conclusions based on footage, the timestamps, and the vehicle's behavior. They're not just guessing, they're drawing inferences based on data and experience. The Ridge Road camera, in particular, captured the cleanest view of the vehicle. It was about 0.3 miles from the crime scene. It's not a leap to imagine a car seen there at 4:01 a.m. is the same one seen at 4:04 a.m. entering the neighborhood. The investigators are expected to explain this pattern at trial, complete with surveillance maps showing the car's alleged route through the area. This matters not just because of what the jury sees, but how the prosecution connects it to Koberger's registered vehicle. The goal is to place his car in the area at the exact time the murders were believed to have occurred. And for those of you playing along at home who may not be super familiar with how far or not far 0.3 miles is, if you live on a block, like an average city block, that's about 6-7 houses down the road. So somebody pulls out of your driveway, passes a few houses, which takes, you know, all of 5 to 10 seconds, there's the car. Not far. Together, these elements, the Amazon account, the knife sheath, the DNA, the vehicle footage, they don't exist in isolation. They form a chain. The prosecution's case is about making that chain feel unbroken. A knife purchased months in advance, a sheath found at the scene, DNA on that sheath, a car that matches the suspect's, a pattern of behavior before and after the crime. The state doesn't need a confession. It just needs enough links that the jury feels they're holding a full chain. Not a pocket full of scraps. But as anyone who's watched a trial knows, no piece of evidence enters the courtroom unchallenged. Every link in that chain comes with its own battle. The defense is already circling with its counterpoints about how data can be misread, how secondary DNA transfer is real, how surveillance isn't a certainty, and how just because a knife was purchased doesn't mean it was used. And that's where we head next. Because while the state is building its version of what happened, the defense is doing the same, brick by brick, rebuttal by rebuttal. They're not poking holes, they're offering a different frame entirely. That's what we're getting into. If the prosecution's case is about stringing together evidence, the defense's job is to pull at every thread and see what unravels. And hopefully the jury doesn't look at that as a petulant child pulling at loose strings in their clothes, ripping it apart as mom and dad screams, "Stop! You're going to ruin that!" They have to be really covert about it. But in a case like this, not every thread gets to be tugged. In April of 25, rulings laid out exactly how far Brian Koberger's defense team is allowed to go and where the judge has drawn the line. Let's just say it's not a free-for-all. Let's start with the alibi, because if you're on trial for four murders, one of the most powerful things you can say is, "I wasn't there." But that only works if it can actually prove where you were and when. Koberger's legal team tried to put forward a partial alibi based on cell phone records. They said that in the early morning hours of November 13th, 2022, he was driving around somewhere south of Pullman, Washington, and west of Moscow, Idaho, the implication being not at 112 or 1112 King Road.
Sounds like the start.
Until you look at the clock. You know, you look at facts, then it doesn't look so good. The alleged murders occurred, and I shouldn't say alleged murders, the murders occurred between approximately 4.07 a.m. and 4.20 a.m. Koberger's cell phone was last actively pinging at 2.54 a.m., and then it was off. Radio silence, no signal, no location, nothing, until it came back at line around 4.48 a.m. The blackout window just happens to line up with the estimated time of the murders. Oh, yeah, you don't want to say murders out of context, right? The murders. The court and pretty much everybody with a slight bit of common sense knows this. The court didn't buy the alibi, not as an alibi anyway. The judge made it clear under Idaho law, the alibi means showing that it was physically impossible for the defendant to be at the crime scene during the time the crime was committed. In other words, a real alibi has to plug the timeline. If your phone goes dark during the key window, it's not an alibi. It's a gap. Now, that doesn't mean the defense can't talk about phone data. They can. They can have their expert, Cy Ray, testified that the cell tower data shows Koberger was elsewhere before and after the murders. Well, guess what? So was everyone else. But what they can't do is call it an alibi in front of the jury, at least not without clearing that with the court first. The kind of language, the judge said, has to be carefully vetted before it gets anywhere near a juror's ears. And speaking of Cy Ray, he's not just involved in the alibi question, he's also at the center of a separate issue that stirred up more than a few conspiracy theories. It's all about AT&T timing advance records. These are the kind of cell phone records that under very specific conditions can estimate how far a phone was from a cell tower at a given time. Koberger's team claims those records could prove he wasn't near the King Road house, but that the state never turned them over. Here's where things get a little messy. AT&T didn't produce those records, according to the state, because they didn't exist. You can't turn something over that's not there. Timing advance data, AT&T says, is only stored for 7 days. The warrants were issued weeks after the murders. By then, the data was gone. The prosecution provided certificates from AT&T confirming this, but Cy Ray, in his infinite wisdom and his affidavit, basically calls foul. He says the records were obtained and are being hidden. Yeah, no, they're not. Sorry. The court not impressed. The judge ruled that Cy Ray could ask one law enforcement witness, Special Agent Balance, whether he received those records. But that's it. If Balance says no, that ends the discussion. The defense can't continue to suggest the state is hiding evidence that they didn't have unless they can prove it. Otherwise, it turns into speculation, and that's not allowed. You can't just make things up and say, you didn't give me this, and I know you had it. No, we don't. Here's everything we have. Check AT&T. They'll tell you the same thing. AT&T says the same thing, but we still think we're right. Okay, now you're just being a petulant child. That's just what it is at that point. It's been a reoccurring theme in these rulings. Speculation. The court is fine with reasonable doubt. It's not fine with rabbit holes. And nowhere is that more clear than in the debate over alternate suspects. The defense has floated the idea that someone else could have committed the murders, maybe more than one person. And to be fair, pointing the finger somewhere is a perfectly valid defense strategy. But in Idaho, you can't just say, it could have been someone else. You have to show why it could have been someone else. You have to present actual evidence that links other people to the crime, not just vibes, rumors, or Reddit threads. So if the court ruled, if Koberger's team wants to introduce alternate perpetrator theories, they will need to submit their evidence by May 14th of 25. Not at trial, not mid-witness. They have to bring it in advance so the judge can review it, and not just any theory will do. It has to show a real, plausible link between another person and the actual commission of the crime. Circumstantial speculation, it's not enough. Otherwise, you run the risk of confusing the jury with a parade of maybe this, maybe that scenarios that don't go anywhere, which pretty much has been their strategy all of this time thus far. That pulls a firm limit on how exactly misdirection and how much misdirection the defense can get away with. The courtroom isn't a detective novel where anyone could be the killer. The rules are stricter than that. The judge made it clear. If you want to point at something else, bring receipts. And then, just when the court seemed like it was sealing off every avenue of reasonable doubt, the judge made a decision that went the other way. It was about a detail that's both incredibly specific and kind of fuzzy at the same time. Bushy eyebrows. That phrase comes from DM, one of the surviving roommates. She's the only eyewitness in this case, and during one of her interviews, she said she saw a man inside the house wearing black clothes and a mask that covered everything except his eyebrows. She said that she remembers seeing the bushy eyebrows. The defense wanted that description thrown out. Their argument, it's unreliable. DM had been drinking that night. She said she was scared and possibly disoriented. She also acknowledged having vivid dreams and trouble distinguishing from reality. On top of that, she initially didn't even mention the eyebrows. That detail came up later during a more thorough police interview several days after the murders. But the court didn't see that at all as a reason to exclude the testimony. The judge ruled that the description was based on DM's personal observation. Whether she was tired or scared, whether her memory evolved, that's something the jury can evaluate for themselves. It's not the court's job to preemptively decide what's reliable and what's not. That's what cross-examination is for. And oh yeah, his shopping list also includes the mask. The mask that shows the eyebrows. So there's that too. So yes, the jury will hear about bushy eyebrows. They'll hear about the only person who saw the intruder, thought he was a white male wearing black with a mask and distinct eyebrows, you know, like that. The testimony might not be definitive, but it is coming in. And it could matter. Because when you stack it next to everything, surveillance videos, DNA, cell data, even a single physical description starts to feel like one more of a puzzle piece. That's what the defense is up against. They're trying to plant seeds of doubt. But they're doing it in a courtroom that's already trimmed the hedges. No alibi, no mystery DNA, no fishing expeditions. They have their tools, cell phone experts, cross-examination, witness inconsistencies, but they're not getting to color outside the lines. Whether that's enough to crack the prosecution's case is something we'll only know when the trial unfolds in full. But make no mistake here, every ruling made so far shapes the path they're walking. This is not a free-flowing courtroom drama. This is a procedural grind, where every claim must come with backup and every doubt has to be earned. And that makes what happens next even more important, because now that we know the limits, the restrictions, and the court-approved pathways, all that's left is the execution. Who says what, how it lands, what the jury believes, all of it begins with a story they're about to be told and how both sides plan to sell it. What are your thoughts on all of this? Tell me in the comments on YouTube. If you're listening to our podcast, wherever you get podcasts, go ahead, check out our YouTube channel, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Comment there, press subscribe. We put all of our content that we put out over on the podcast onto YouTube and vice versa. You just get to see me animated, moving my hands around a lot, and holding this pen when you watch us on YouTube. I can't operate without my pen. I'm always like, if it's not on my desk, I'm like, where's my pen? Anyway, tell me what your thoughts are. I'd love to hear it and engage in the conversation with you. And like I said, please press subscribe wherever you download podcasts so you don't miss any of our coverage on this case or the many that we follow for you right here at True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers Podcast. My name is Tony Bruschi, and I thank you so much for spending 32 minutes with me. I do appreciate that. We'll talk soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.
What if I told you that right now, millions of people are living with a debilitating condition that's so misunderstood, many of them don't even know that they have it? That condition is obsessive compulsive disorder, or OCD. I'm Dr. Patrick McGrath, the Chief Clinical Officer of NOCD. And in the 25 years I've been treating OCD, I've met so many people who were suffering from the condition in silence, unaware of just what it was. OCD can create overwhelming anxiety and fear around what you value most, make you question your identity, beliefs, and morals, and drive you to perform mentally and physically draining compulsions or rituals. Over my career, I've seen just how devastating OCD can be when it's left untreated. But help is available. That's where NOCD comes in. NOCD is the world's largest virtual therapy provider for obsessive compulsive disorder. Our licensed therapists are trained in exposure and response prevention therapy, a specialized treatment proven to be incredibly effective for OCD. So visit NOCD.com to schedule a free 15-minute call with our team. That's NOCD.com.